Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest edition of the Providence Journal's College Basketball Podcast. This is Bill Koch from our downtown studios in Providence. I'm a sports writer with the Journal. I'm joined by my co-conspirator for this episode. He is the sports director at ABC6 and the weekend co-host of Cordishi and Coit on WEEI in Providence. Nick Coit, ladies and gentlemen. Coity, how we living?
Hello, Bill. What's going on?
I'm doing okay. It's been a busy week. Lots of activity with our college basketball teams, with the Red Sox, which is the beat I will transition to after March Madness. The Red Sox continue to get ready for spring training. And as it stands right now, Coity, we're going to have an earlier focus than has been typical in this market over the last few years. In terms of where our teams sit as it relates to the NCAA tournament, Providence right now, outside the bubble, you or I outside the bubble, Bryant on pause, looking at a one bid league in the NEC typically as it is, our best hope right now could be the URI women, the way that they're playing. Right. I don't necessarily think that most A-10 insiders would look and say that they can compete with VCU or Dayton, who are typically the power programs in that league, and Fordham. But I wouldn't discount the Lady Rams at this point. They've got something going there.
Well, when you have a coach that has the energy and the passion that Tammy Reese has, it's evident that, I think people are going to feed off of that type of thing. Mm. And I think you're seeing that with the program. I mean, she just... she is, what an interesting person she is, right? And just like I said, just the fiery, nature that she has, and just the enthusiasm, and it's great. It's refreshing to see. You love to see that in somebody that comes in and takes over a program. And when you compete the way they did against Fordham, I know that their winning streak was snapped, and but they competed against a good program in the A-10, and look, it is what it is. I mean, they're competing against those type of teams. You're going to continue to do that going forward. That's a good thing.
Yeah, I think the best compliment that you could pay to any coach, manager, anyone like that is you can get your players or your employees to perform at a high level for you and to completely buy in. And I think that's something that she's gotten from the URI women. I also think it's something that she's demanded from day one. She makes no bones about the fact that you're either going to play hard and buy all the way in, or you're just not going to play. And she is recruited to that culture. They've gone the international route. They have six players from France, one holdover from Portugal, Marta Vargas, because they have traditionally struggled. And you're not necessarily going to be able to sell your program within the United States to recruits here who look at your history and say, well, you've never won. Why would I come play for you? You go to the overseas kids, you use that market, it's sort of an opportunity for them to come play college basketball in the States that they might not otherwise have. When you're trying to get the best kid in New York or New Jersey or Massachusetts or, maybe a little outside that region, they look at Rhode Island and they say, you guys have made one NCAA tournament. And that was in 1996. I'm not going to put my future in your hands. Not just yet, but in the future, if they're able to continue to build this and they're able to keep Tammy Reese in Kingston, her roster composition could change and their end goals could change.
Well, we have talked about it, off the podcast before, about when I was working in Bangor, Maine, and covering the University of Maine up there, and the women's program was being rebuilt. It started pretty much the time that I started up there, and I worked for 2 years up there. And a guy who's now the men's coach up there, Richard Barron, came over and took over the women's program. And, a lot of people were talking about Richard because, he had been part of the Baylor program, I believe, and helped to recruit Brittany Griner, which to me, you say that, you say, wow, okay, well. Yeah, I think he has an idea of how to recruit and try to build a program.
Yeah.
And so he goes up there, and I'll always remember one of the first things I covered that summer before we even really got into the women's season, that first winter, was he had a lobster dinner on his front lawn at his house.
Excellent.
He invited all the benefactors, anybody that was ever associated with the women's program for the Black Bears, and said, come on over. We're cooking lobster, which in Maine is, I mean, that is a great thing during the summertime. What's better?
Absolutely.
And he invited a bunch of people, and they literally set up tables on his front lawn. And that to me was like, huh. Well, this guy's trying to, he is getting personal with the people that he knows can help him build the program.
Right.
And then he went the international route recruiting. And that's what Tammy is doing as well. And because up there, you know, I think Maine has had some success in the past. I think of people like Cindy Blodgett up there.
Oh, sure.
But when you're trying to rebuild it, you say, okay, let's bring kids in and let's sell them on coming over, getting a good education in the United States, and playing college basketball for a program that, you know, they don't care internationally as much about, like, you know, oh, man, this program's a perennial, oh, this and that. They care about the opportunity, and they care about the education and the experience that they're going to get.
Right.
And I think going the international route, that can help you build things up. And I think as time has gone on, I think UMaine up there has gotten some more recruits and more players from the States to help them, you know, go the direction they have. And they are a perennial at the top of America East now. And that's been that way for probably about 5-6 years. And so I think Tammy's kind of going that route and is finding some success early on.
Yeah, there's more than one way to build a house. It's not paint by numbers.
Yeah.
You know, recruiting is a complex science, mm-hmm. I think you could say. You can go the four-year route, the transfer route, the JUCO route, the international route. The best programs do it all, are capable of doing it all, because they can offer so much to their student athletes, you know. But good on Rhody. We look forward to seeing what they do over the next few weeks. We're also going to start with some news on the podcast out of the Ivy League, and I think this is really good news for Mike Martin and his Brown Bears. The Ivy League is going to allow student athletes, seniors this year in 2020-21, to take an extra graduate year in 21-22. It's unprecedented. The league has never done that before, but they are not sponsoring fall and winter sports. And so they're going to give those seniors an opportunity to compete for one final time. Why is that important for the Bears? They have one of their better players that they've had under Mike Martin and Tam and Ang Cho, who is a senior, who could be retained on the east side. A couple other influential players there, obviously. You know, with Jake Shaper and the Barrington native Matt DeWolf. You know, Brown, as we talked about before the season, looked like a team that could challenge for the top four in the Ivy League and get into the Ivy League tournament. If they're able to retain Tam and Ang, who is in the transfer portal as we record this on a Friday afternoon, and is no doubt hearing from other schools in different conferences, programs that might be quote-unquote better than Brown, you know, might be in the Power 5, might be in the Atlantic 10, you know, could be somewhere in the Big East, could offer a little more in terms of charter flights, practice facilities, things that he hasn't experienced in his college career. If he is not drawn by those, however, if he would like to come back to Brown for a fifth season, the Bears could be positioned to be right back up near the top of the Ivy League. So a big ruling by the conference and could be a very favorable one for Brown.
I'm just really glad that the Council of Presidents for the Ivy League sort of looked at this, came to their senses and said, this is different. This is unprecedented. This is not a typical situation. So we need to make an exception here. And I'm disappointed they didn't come to this realization sooner, but they have come to that realization. You know, because if they did come to it sooner, say in November when they said they weren't going to have winter sports and they had already pushed off fall and winter sports into next year, then you know, you may have been able to have somebody like Tam and Ang Cho or somebody like Paul Atkinson at Yale or somebody like a Jimmy Boeheim at Cornell. Instead of them hearing from all these schools and going through this whole process, they would have been able to say, okay, well, I can keep working with my team and stick around and not even get the sort of enticing that they have. But
right. That
is what it is. I think the simple fact is this is a different time period. This is an exception to their usual standards, and so I'm glad that they ruled on this. I understand why they don't typically do grad and grad transfers and grad players because of the academics and the institutions, and I get that they try to uphold those standards and whatnot. Could they look at this again? I don't know. It was obviously like pulling teeth trying to for this to happen after, you know, 3 months after they canceled the season.
Right.
So I don't know if this would become a permanent thing. But you look at the talent that leaves the Ivy League, particularly in basketball, and goes to higher places. You know, if these schools and institutions really look and say we, you know, have priorities with athletics, or really think that athletics can, you know, further our institutions, then you look at the talent that's gone different places. You know, you look at the Columbia kid from last year, Smith.
Yeah, Mike Smith going to Michigan.
You look at Bryce Aiken going to Seton Hall.
Right.
You look at some of these players that have gone off to different and higher and power programs and have contributed in large ways. And you look at it and you say, well, boy, if we can keep them around another year, they're highlighting and they're pushing forward our league that they were a part of.
Right.
So, you know, that's a different discussion for down the road. But again, just it's I'm glad that they came to this ruling and this standard. And now T has a chance to really evaluate his options here and say, okay, well, I've heard from the schools that I've heard from. You know, last that we had heard, he had received interest from Seton Hall, from St. Bonaventure, from schools like Loyola Chicago, South Florida, San Diego State. Those are all good programs.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, particularly look at San Diego State last year. Like, holy cow. You know, that was something, even though Brown beat them a couple years ago at their place. But, you know, that is what it is.
Loyola Chicago's in the Final Four a couple years ago.
Oh, who could forget?
I think right now, you know, they're top 15 in the net.
Yeah.
You know, they're trending back towards an NCAA tournament bid this year.
Yeah. This is all really, really good programs. But, you know, I think this gives T a chance to say, okay, where would I fit in with these programs? What kind of opportunity would I be leaving for? And is it worth me now leaving Brown, where I would be the focal point? I would be the guy.
Right.
I would be the leader of this program, and I'd be one of the two, you know, at least two captains for next year. Before the season was canceled, it was Tam and Cho and David Mitchell that were named captains. So he could be a leader for this program. He could stay with Mike. You know, either way, I don't blame him for whatever decision that he makes. You know, it's nice that he has all these options. He deserves it. You know, he's a great kid and a great player. Now he has the option, though, if he wants to come back to Brown, he can do that. And Mike can make his pitch, and the staff can make their pitch, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, the other thing, most importantly, is he's going to have a degree from Brown University either way.
The most important thing.
We think that he's on track to graduate in 4 years. We assume that he is. He is a bright kid. I wouldn't think that he's behind in any way on his degree requirements, you know, and that is, you know, the recruiting pitch in the Ivy League is 4 for 40, 4 years now for your next 40 years of your life, you know, and that's something that will set him up well beyond basketball, you know, so interested to see what happens with the Bears over the next few months, you know. Do really like the fact that the Ivy League ultimately did come to this decision.
Me too.
Setting a really good precedent here in the midst of a global pandemic, which no one has ever seen. You know, no one walking the earth currently. You know, obviously they had to deal with this 100 years ago, but no one who's making decisions now was around then, last I checked. You know, we will stay in Providence with our next portion of the podcast. We will go to the Friars. And I look at Providence and I think back to, you know, you could say it is the trademark scene from Godfather 3. It was recreated in at least a couple episodes of The Sopranos. The famous Michael Corleone line, just when I thought I was out,
They pulled me back in.
Have they pulled you back in, Coity? Have the Friars done so after their win on Wednesday, 70-59 against UConn, snapping a three-game losing streak, finally showing some signs of complete 40-minute basketball, competent basketball at both ends? Against Seton Hall, they were inept offensively. Against St. John's, they couldn't get any defensive stops. They were pretty much run off the floor at that end by the Red Storm, who look pretty potent at this point. This was more towards the complete 40-minute effort that you would expect from the Friars that we might have expected to see more often entering the season. So do they have you back, Coity?
I'm picturing I'm picturing Al Pacino in my head.
In the kitchen, in the sweater. Right? Yeah, right. Yeah, the aging Don. Yeah.
Oh, goodness. It's a great line.
Yeah.
Have they pulled me back in? I am never out on the Friars until the mathematics say so.
They're like Rasputin, aren't they?
Yeah, you cannot count the. You just can't count them out. You just. That's the way that Ed Cooley's teams have been. Until the mathematics say it, you don't count them out. You can't do it. Because they'll have a performance like they did against UConn where you're like, well, is it? I don't know. I don't know, Jim. To steal the Tony Romo line.
All right.
It was better. Just putting it together consistently. And the trend has been, through Big East play here, that it hasn't been consistent. They haven't been able to put it together, right, all the time. But I think when David Duke has the performance that he had in the first half, and Nate Watson has the performance that he had in the second half, mm-hmm, and you're getting the contributions from the bench in different ways, you put that all together, and it's a recipe for giving the Friars a chance to win. Noah Horkler has been very good the last couple of games, a good contributor for them, mm-hmm, and they've put him in the starting five. But the St. John's game, yes, Noah was good, but everybody coming off the bench, one bench point. One guy scored a point off the bench.
And they had 81 points in the game.
Yeah. You have to get more. Tough to say with 81 points, but you got to get more, right, out of the guys that are role players, that are coming onto the floor to do something specific for them. Now, I'll give the Friars this. We don't know what the situation is with Jimmy Nichols. Hopefully he is okay and whatever's going on with him.
Yeah.
But they hinted that it is season ending for him, which is unfortunate because in terms of role players, I thought Jimmy was taking a major step forward for them this year. I thought he was important for them in a few different ways. So then he's off the floor. You're trying to figure things out. Still no Jared Bynum, unfortunately.
Right.
Ed is playing some different guys. Bryson Goodine's gotten some minutes here recently. Chris Monroe's gotten some minutes recently. And so when you're making those sorts of changes, to your rotation this late in the season, you start to try to find things that are sticking and guys that are trying to stand out in different roles, and then that sort of, that leads to some of the issues that you've had. But the encouraging thing was with the UConn game, I thought the defense was better.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they simplified it a little bit more, because I felt like they just, I don't know, they weren't trying to do too much defensively, Bill. I thought it was, it was solid. And on the boards, I thought they were good enough. They were good enough. And Noah Horkler, okay, 9 points, but he comes down with 10 rebounds. Like that to me is it's a big thing when you've had the struggles you've had rebounding like you did at Georgetown. So am I out on the Friars? Have I been out on the Friars? No. Because again, until the mathematics say so, you never know. And opportunity knocks. You get UConn again coming up on Tuesday. I mean, after the DePaul game here, you play well in that game. That's an opportunity to knock off a team that's ahead of you in terms of net ranking. Then you get Xavier, who's, on the cusp of, I believe they're on the cusp of a quad one.
33 in the net. They need to move up three spots.
But they're right there. So that could be an opportunity. That could move up. Then you get St. John's again, and then you get Villanova.
Right.
You go on a run. However, it's got to be tough to do something like that, but these are good teams that we're talking about. But if you go on a run, Bill, mathematics say it's in your favor.
Yeah.
And if you are going on a run, that means you're playing better, you're doing things and finding ways to win. And so, are they they pulled me back in. But you know what, Bill? I never was truly out of it, Billy. I never was truly out of it with the Friars.
I understand, and it's hard to be. You hit on a lot of points there. We'll take them as they come. First, we hope Jimmy Nichols is okay. He's dealing with an unspecified illness. They have not officially ruled him out for the year. It is not COVID. He's tested negative for COVID. They don't have a specific diagnosis that they're sharing with us yet. We just hope the young man's okay.
Yes.
We hope that, eventually he's able to come back, whether it's late this year, next year, whatever it may be, and that he's all right. the math. We could start with the math, because everyone's going to look at bracketology at this point in the year, and everyone's crunching the numbers and trying to see, you know, where they land, if they're on the right side of the bubble or not. As we sit here on Friday afternoon, Providence would be out of the tournament. They are 86 in the net. They are 74 in KenPom, 53 in strength of schedule. They are 2-5 against Quadrant 1. The interesting thing for Providence, since we really last took a close look at this, is they suddenly have three Quadrant 1 games left. At the time, I think they only had two. Xavier is 33 in the net. If they can get up to 30, Providence has four Quadrant 1 games left. That screams opportunity. At UConn, Xavier home. At St. John's, Villanova home. Now, what you're talking about, really, is Providence having to run the table or go 3-1 in those games. And obviously, they cannot lose it to DePaul, who they play Saturday night. That's a non-negotiable. If that happens, the path is you know, could truly be completely gone.
Right.
You know, but Providence is it's an interesting thing when you're in the Big East. You can sort of go up and down and ride these swings and still have a chance, because the strength of the league, the depth of the league is good enough, and they're playing the right teams at the end. They're done with Marquette. They're done with Butler. You know, those drags on their schedule and those landmines, frankly, if you lose, are out of the way. You know, did they sweep Marquette and Butler? No. But no one is going to look at those as completely disqualifying losses. They would rather look at who you've beaten. And if you're able to sweep UConn, split with St. John's, who right now would be on the bubble, pushing to get in. They've been one of the hottest teams in the Big East. If you're able to beat Villanova at home, who is a potential number one seed in the field, and get a split with them, the committee's going to look favorably on all of that. You know, so there is a mathematical path for Providence to get there. If you want to boil it down to one specific game, which was against UConn, Providence played much better defense, as you alluded to. UConn was 4-for-20 from three-point range. Most importantly, though, Providence got two contributions from guys not named Nate Watson and David Duke. They both had 17 points in this game. I thought David was really good to start the second half. He sort of sparked Providence into the way they played over the last 20 minutes. But A.J. Reeves playing a complete game, 10 points, but also 7 rebounds and 6 assists,
yep,
against just one turnover. Noah Horkler playing a complete game, 37 minutes, 9 points, 10 rebounds, 1 turnover, doing the dirty work underneath. You know, Providence out-rebounded UConn, one of the top offensive rebounding teams in the country, and Providence was able to do a good enough job of keeping them off the glass. You know, it was sort of the very blue-collar, you know, gritty, determined performances that have sort of been trademarks under Ed Cooley that we've seen too few of this season, that they've sort of veered away from at times. St. John's was a really good example of that. They sort of let the Red Storm do whatever they want. 92 points is the most they've allowed in regulation under Ed Cooley. That's 323 games. But I saw a Providence team on Wednesday that I had expected to see all season.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong. Were they in man for most of the game?
What I liked about their defense is that they extended their pressure a little bit.
Okay.
They did show some zone,
mm-hmm,
at times. But what I liked was, you know, UConn's very deliberate in terms of pace. Without James Booknight, who is fantastic, they don't have much dynamism at guard. You know, R.J. Cole isn't necessarily going to beat you. Brendan Adams isn't necessarily going to beat you. Jalen Gaffney hasn't been consistent enough to beat you. They lack that spark in the backcourt.
Right.
And so what Providence did by extending their pressure was they drained the shot clock on UConn. UConn is getting over midcourt, and they're starting their offensive actions with 18 seconds on the clock instead of 23 or 24. It makes them even more deliberate. They get deeper into the clock. They get down under 10. They press a little bit. They take a bad shot. You know, there's a lot of indiscriminate jacking from three. You're fortunate that Tyler Polley didn't have a good day. He was 1-for-8 from deep. He's normally a very good shooter for them. You know, so Providence pretty much, you know, I really liked the game plan that they used, and yeah, I really liked the way that they executed it.
Yeah, it just, it seemed like they had a plan, and you're right. They just went out there and they did it, and they did it to, you know, the best of their ability. And we haven't seen that necessarily, you know, for some of this Big East schedule. And I think a lot of times too, this team tends to. I think we saw a lot of that probably, you know, in the Georgetown game when they're getting beat on the boards the way that they do, it really deflates you because you can play good defense, you know, as they have at times this year, and then all of a sudden, you know, they get an extra possession out of it because they beat you on the glass.
Right.
And so that wasn't happening, obviously, in this game. You're getting the stops. And so maybe that's just what it was that, you know, you notice about it was just the fact that, you know, when they got the stops that they needed, they were able to limit second chances, third chances for the Huskies.
Stops don't end with a missed shot.
Yeah.
They end with a defensive rebound.
Right.
And an outlet pass. Mm-hmm. You have not stopped the opponent until you have grabbed the board. And against Georgetown, we saw how painful that could be. 17 offensive rebounds for the Hoyas, a game that Providence never should have lost. Never, never, never. But they do have a couple of those losses, and that's why they are where they are.
Right.
At 10-10 overall, at 6-8 in the Big East, squarely on the wrong side of the bubble. But that game against UConn, we've been waiting for a turning point from the Friars. We thought it might have been the road win at Creighton. Home overtime win over Marquette. You're thinking, okay, this is a chance to build momentum. They'd lost three in a row after the Marquette win coming into Connecticut.
Yeah.
Maybe this is the time. And really, they don't have much more time.
No, they don't. They don't. And I think you said it right, too. This was the type of game. This is the formula. This is the formula for them to win. David Duke plays well. Nate Watson plays well. You get contributions from guys that aren't David Duke or Nate Watson, you know, all around on the stat sheet. And you limit the other team to, you know, in this game, under 60 points. You know, I'd say under 70, maybe mid-60s. You give yourself a chance
right.
to win the game. And that is an Ed Cooley staple. I've brought this up on the podcast before, but I don't think I'll ever forget seeing that game at Villanova last year that you won 50-something to 50-something.
58-54.
That was some of the ugliest, in terms of, like, you know, as if you want to rate it on being an exciting product or whatnot.
Yeah.
That's probably far from it, Bill. It's ugly, but it's down-in-the-mud kind of basketball, and that is what I think when Ed walked away from that game, he said, I love it.
Right.
Why? Because my team played really well defensively, and we scored enough to win the game.
Right.
You know, and we did it efficiently. We took advantage of our opportunities. That game's going to stick in my head from last season because that is what I think of when I think of, like, you know, what's a formula for an Ed Cooley team. And
right.
I know it's not sexy. I know it's not exciting. I know it's not 90 points. And Ed has had guys that can play very well offensively, and
sure.
he's had teams that can score more than that.
Sure.
But a win is a win. And when you play that well defensively, which I think Ed can coach them up very well defensively, you know, the guys that he brings into the program, you know, that they'll take it.
Now, in terms of points per 100 possessions, this is the worst defensive team they've had in 7 years.
Right.
I don't think that their record is a coincidence. You look at someone like Monet or Picasso or Van Gogh, the judgment of art is subjective. You look and you say, this is great art, this is not great art. Basketball is very simple. It's very definitive. You win or you lose.
Yeah.
And whether it's pretty or not, if you want to play at Kentucky or at UCLA or in Kansas, you can quibble about style while you're winning 30 games in a typical year, or what your boosters think you should win, whether it's, you know, going 30-8 and being the Final Four every other year, whatever. You can quibble about, oh, the coach is boring and the team's boring and they play a bad style. Are they winning? If they're winning, generally,
who cares?
You're going to be happy.
Yeah.
Providence plays ugly against UConn. They win. It was a lot prettier game against St. John's. They lost, I would think, 100 times out of 100. If it was possible, 105 times out of 100. Ed Cooley's taking the UConn game and saying, thank you very much. Let's move on.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but 92 points was the most that an Ed Cooley team had allowed in regulation?
In regulation.
Yeah.
In 323 games.
He can't like that. At all. That's got to be at the top of his list of, please, Don't ever show me that again.
He was threatening to not watch the Super Bowl.
Yeah,
after
right.
That game.
Yikes.
Ed Cooley, a big football fan, a big Tom Brady fan. It would have been unlikely for him not to watch the Super Bowl. He, in fact, did watch the Super Bowl. Thoroughly enjoyed the win by the Tampa Bay Bucks, and reminded us at the end of his Zoom call after the UConn game that Tom Brady is, in fact, the GOAT. He warned us not to dismiss 40-somethings, whether they be coaches, athletes, whatever it may be. I think that was a bit of a midlife crisis moment from Ed. Maybe he's trying to remind us, you know, he was swapping in 50-something. He's saying maybe, you know, don't dismiss me because I'm a 50-something.
Careful.
I don't know. You know, but that's... it was a he veered a bit into ageism there, but it was entertaining as usual.
I'm going to save my Tom Brady thoughts for Saturday from 7 to 9 a.m. on 103.7 WEEI.
Oh, show plug. Very good. Very good. See that, folks? Coit is a complete professional. You can just work that in, and it doesn't sound forced. It's a beautiful thing.
Thanks.
So Providence will play at DePaul Saturday night, 8 o'clock on Fox Sports 1. Whether it's brewing coffee or finding your favorite libation, you know, prepare for a little bit of a late game in that one, a late tip. A game that Providence absolutely needs to have. You lose that one, and as I said, the math, the path toward the NCAA could disappear completely.
Sure.
You know, that's definitely one that you cannot lose.
Right.
We go to the Rhodey Rams, who are going to be on a well-deserved bye here until next Tuesday against Dayton. You know, Rhodey's played 21 games. It's among the most in the country. They have not been on COVID pause yet. We commend them for their discipline in that way. But they are struggling on the floor when they are able to get out there. The most recent result was against a team who has been on COVID pause for an extended period here in 2021. That's St. Louis, a 67-60 loss at the Billikens on Wednesday night. The Friars played in the afternoon. The Rams played a little later. I was able to watch both. You know, Rhodey's on a four-game losing streak for the second time in 3 years. Against the Billikens, they did something that they have not done in the KenPom era, which goes back to 2001-02. They only forced four turnovers, which is the fewest they've forced in the last 19 seasons. 6% of St. Louis's possessions ended in turnovers. That's the fewest as well.
Wow.
In 19 seasons. You know, so URI played good positional defense, but they did not generate anything easy for themselves. They were outscored off turnovers 15-2. They were outscored on the fast break 14-0. And against a team like St. Louis, who is so physical, who digs in, who plays so hard at that end of the court on defense, it would be nice to get something easy. And URI was not able to do that. They shot 32.8%, generally having a fist fight with the most physical team in the league. It's not necessarily the game plan, the remedy for solving what is a very tough and physical St. Louis team. And, you know, so we have URI with one scheduled home game left, could end up being two. But for now, on paper, they only have Dayton left on Tuesday. You know, the Rams are outside the NCAA tournament picture. They have no way back aside from winning the A-10 tournament. Coity, I wonder where you see these guys, you know, with no wins here in February and on a four-game losing streak.
Yeah, it's tough because I think in some ways, you know, we see flashes again with this team of, you know, what they can be when they play well, when they take care of the basketball. I think the St. Louis game is a tougher one to, I think, evaluate, because I do think St. Louis as a program, with the guys that they have, guys that they've had in the program for a couple of years with Goodwin and Hassan French, who is just a man. He's just a man. That's a tough team to go up against and to try to evaluate yourself. I think that's why we saw David Cox in the post game. You know, the program had just lost its fourth straight game, and he was actually in an okay mood. It wasn't like he was going in there and dejected and whatnot. I think he was okay with his guys' effort in that game. And I think a coach is always pleased when he feels like his team, you know, gave a good effort and gave a good shot. He realizes what talent that St. Louis has as well. You know, when you go up against a guy like French, you know, I think one of the factors in that game, Mikal Mitchell getting into foul trouble, that obviously didn't help, because he is has been a good player and is a good player for this program. And behind him, in terms of your depth there, you know, it gets a little tougher to keep things going, because I don't necessarily think you've gotten the production that you want behind him, you know, in the front court. So,
sure.
Yeah, the St. Louis game is tougher to me. You know, I had gone to you know, the UMass game on Saturday, and I think the disappointing part with that was you have a tie game midway through the second half, and the. The energy, and I think David Cox used the word urgency, wasn't there with this team. And that is, maybe that's why I think Cox felt better about the effort at St. Louis, because he felt like more of that was there.
Yep.
Which to me, though, says, Bill, that this team plays to its competition.
Mm-hmm.
And that necessarily, that's a worry and a concern, because when you're a team in any sport, you want to have your identity. Who are you? What do people think of when they play your team?
Right.
And we were just talking about what Ed Cooley strives to be with his Providence teams and what they can be when they play well. In the mud, play you well defensively, score enough so that you win the game and you hold off the opponent. What is the identity of this URI team? Are they still searching for it? I think in some ways they might be, Bill.
Yeah, I look at them and, you know, I'm with you. The UMass loss to me is a lot worse than the St. Louis loss.
Yeah.
A lot more indictable, considering that the UMass is missing two starters. They're missing their best player. Trey Mitchell's out. Noah Fernandez is out. So you're missing an all A-10 front court guy and your point guard. You know, and you go on the road, you have a 5-point lead late, and you go on a 10-0 run, and URI just sort of fades away in that game, and it is disconcerting. You know, not just that you lost and you got swept by UMass, but how you lost. You know, the fact that you wilted down the stretch, that you didn't have a field goal in the last 5 minutes, you know, against a team that really doesn't try to defend. You know, they really don't stop anybody. You know, we saw Bryant put up 93 points against them.
Yeah.
On the road.
Right.
Earlier this year.
Right.
You know, so not necessarily that loss is you know, that one's a lot more indictable than the St. Louis game. I think St. Louis is better than you. I think it would have taken, you know, something a little special to beat them. You know, Jordan Goodwin is the best player on the floor in that
yes.
game. He has 17 points, 11 rebounds, 6 assists. He's forced to play point guard, essentially, after Yuri Collins goes out in the first minute with an ankle injury. You know, to me, when I see a team without its point guard still only commit 4 turnovers, I wonder, you know, if there might have been an adjustment there, if you might have pressured them more, if you might have reacted to personnel more, or if you were, you know, maybe more focused on playing them solidly in the half court and you know, sort of limiting who they are offensively. St. Louis wasn't great in this game from the field. They were 16 for 41 from two. They shot 32% from three. You know, URI played good enough defense. But I think this goes back to, is URI capable of imposing their will on anybody from a physical standpoint? They just look to be a very passive team in that regard. You know, you look at the last two games in particular. Against UMass, you play it in 74 possessions. That's their that's their tempo.
Right.
Against St. Louis, you play it in 67 possessions. Yeah, that's maybe a little closer to who they wanted to be without their point guard for 39 minutes. They did slow it down a little bit. Typically, they played a little quicker on offense, but you know, in that game, they did sort of grind it out. They were content to sort of, you know, fight you in the half court because they thought they'd be more physical than you, tougher than you. They'd beat you on the glass. You know, you're just looking at URI still 21 games into the year, just searching for who they are and who they should play.
Identity.
You know, and it's just, you would have hoped that they would have arrived at that certainly by some point earlier than this. You know, I look at this team right now, and it's a team that is in danger of playing on a Wednesday at the A-10 tournament.
Yeah.
You know, finishing in the bottom four in the league, which is, you know, if they end up playing all the games and the records end up, you know, whatever they end up, I don't know how they're going to do seeding. You know, but right now Rhode Island's 10th. George Washington, LaSalle, Fordham, and St. Joe's are behind them. That's the dregs of the conference. You don't want to be, you know, down there with those teams.
Especially with the talent you have.
Certainly. And with who you've been
recently.
You know, last year you struggled down the stretch, but you were a fringe NCAA team. You were solidly in the field for 23 games. 2018, you're the regular season champions. 2017, you win the tournament.
Yeah.
You know, that's supposed to be your culture, the standard that you've set. That's supposed to be who you are now in Kingston. And they are not that right now.
And I'll give them this, too. Fats Russell has been playing through something the whole year. Multiple things.
Multiple things.
And that has, a large bearing on, you know, where the team is.
Because
I know he had 15 points in that game, but, you know, he's been struggling shooting from the field. You can tell when he's out there. He's grinding through, and that's a credit to Fats and his toughness.
Right.
I mean, we've always known the kid to be tough. You know, but when he's trying to do that, you know, maybe he tries to do a little too much, you know, himself too. You know, not to say he can take all it. To me, he's one of those players that he has earned the shots that he wants to take, and so he can take them. So looking at the shooting numbers, look, I know they're down. I know what they are, but I think it's a direct result of just everything that he's trying to play through.
Right.
I think where it really sticks out for me is, you know, one, you know, the injuries, I think, hamper, you know, some of the quickness that he's able to show when he's fully healthy.
Yes.
Because he can be a gnat defensively, and he can be all over the floor. And the fact that he can, I think, better help his teammates around him when he's healthy.
Right.
You know, he had one assist in the St. Louis game. You know, we know Fats can set guys up more than that. So I think that needs to be said, because I think it is a big bearing on where this team is
right now. I agree. The best version of them was with Fats Russell as a first-team All-A-10 player, as a preseason nominee for the Naismith Trophy for the Wooden Award. You know, somebody who was on the national radar in terms of what he hoped to accomplish this season. He's playing through things that are not going to get healthy and will not be 100%. Whether they sit him now until the start of the A-10 tournament or otherwise. He's dealing with a core muscle injury. He's dealing with a heel injury that David Cox described as something like plantar fasciitis. Something like that requires full rest for 6 to 8 weeks.
Yes.
By then, we're into April. You know, so unless you're going to rest him until the Final Four and you think you're going to win, you know, the next 10, 12 games without him, that's certainly not... you know, that's certainly not going to happen. You know, we asked David about that after the St. Louis game, and he said, and I tend to agree with him on this, he said Fats is a senior. He's given so much to the program. He's earned the right to be out there if he says he can play.
Yep.
You know, yes, there is a part where you would hope the coach would save the player from himself, but I understand why he's not doing it.
Yeah.
I get it. You know, you feel like you owe it to the kid. You would think that he's going to graduate and turn professional after this year. That is his right. He could return for an extra season. You know, but I would think that he's going to want to go to Europe, you know, maybe have a chance at a tryout for the G League, you know, and try and make his way into professional basketball. And I think he's going to have a long and successful career in that venue. It's just a question of whether or not he wants to start it. You know, but I look at this team, and the best version of this team obviously had Fats Russell performing at a high level.
Right.
You know, and physically he just has not been able to do that. You know, there are some other tweaks that I would like to see from these guys, whether it be, you know, in terms of rotation or in terms of style of play. You know, our other co-conspirator on the podcast, Maury Hirschgordon, from WPRI-12. He dropped a column earlier this week, provocative piece, you know, breaking down minutes allocations and sort of, you know, rotations and things that, you know, he feels like you or I should be addressing here. Specifically, after the UMass game, you're looking at Antoine Walker. You know, Antoine Walker in that game had a pair of career highs, 26 points, 14 rebounds. He only played 24 minutes. And the question was, you know, why didn't he play more? You know, so I did a little bit of a statistical deep dive of my own. Antoine, in 21 games, has played 24 minutes or more 9 times. He's gotten you double-digit points or rebounds in 7 of those games. You know, he's had 3 double-doubles. In terms of minutes played this year, he's been one of their most productive players. He's at 21.8 minutes per game, 9 points a game, 6.5 rebounds. He's playing 3 more minutes per game than Malik Martin, who's at 4.9 points and 3.3 rebounds. You know, so you look at that and you say, well, why is it only 3 minutes more a game than Malik Martin? Mm-hmm. You know, why isn't he pushing what Fats Russell is playing at 32 or what Jeremy Shepard is playing at 30? You know, those are just little things. Those are nitpicks that you make when your team is losing. If they're winning, you're not having these conversations, to be fair.
Correct.
You know, but part of the reason why you're struggling the way you are is potentially the way that you're using the talent on hand, you know, the guys who you do have. This would be a different team if Fats was healthy and if Mekhi Mitchell was still healthy. You know, this could potentially be the team that beat Seton Hall earlier this year, that had a couple nice wins in the bubble against South Florida and San Francisco. You know, team that played Western Kentucky all the way down to the end, who potentially could be a tournament team. Team that won at VCU. We've seen the flashes of it. You know, but the way these guys are being used, the way they are playing, their style of play, it has left them 9-12, 6-8 in the A-10, and really questioning where they're going to go, what the arc of this is. I think back to when Dan Hurley started here. The last time they finished under 500 overall was his second season. They were 14-18. They had young players on that team. It was E.C. Matthews. It was Hassan Martin. You know, those guys were freshmen. You know, you're looking at that roster, and it's largely incomplete. There's no Jared Terrell yet. There's no Jarvis Garrett yet. You know, you're playing a rotation that only really has one senior, and that's Xavier Munford, and he was a stopgap type of guy.
Right.
And you saw what happened after, but more importantly, I think you saw the trajectory. You saw who they had signed, who they had recruited. You could see that they were pointing in a certain direction, and that was up. Right now, I look at these guys, and I think if Fats Russell turns pro and Jeremy Shepard turns pro, he's in his mid-20s. His pro career is only going to last for so long. If I was an agent, I would come to him and say, look, you're 24 years old. I think it's time. You really want to be doing this when you're 25. Your opportunities could be less. You're only going to have prime earning years for 6 or 7 instead of 7 or 8. That could make a huge difference. Do you want to go? You know, I look and I think of this roster next year, just with Ishmael Leggett in the backcourt, returning, really playing meaningful minutes. You know, yeah, you should be pretty good in the front court, but you're not going to be picked among the top teams in the league. This is not going to clearly be an NCAA tournament team next year. You know, so they're in a very uncertain place as a program, as I see it. You know, they're in a place where I don't necessarily know where this is going game to game or year to year. And if I was a URI fan, I think that's probably what would be the most unsettling thing about this.
I think it's a fair analysis. I think it's a fair analysis and a fair look at where they are. And I think, yeah, one of the things that stands out to me in terms of, okay, what's a building block? Where are we going? Who's the future? Who's going to lead this program? And, you know, one of the only guys I really think of is Ish Leggett. And I'm glad that they're starting him. I'm glad that they kept him in there with Fats back in the starting five against St. Louis. I think he should start the rest of the way.
Agreed.
Look, I'm not coaching the team, but you know, I think that they see what we all see, which is, you know, this kid can be, you know, a lead dog for you, you know, the next three seasons after this. And I know he had a freshman game against the Billikens. That's what it happens. We've seen it happen with Alan Breed at PC. Like, when freshmen go out there, sometimes they have a game where it's like, okay, well, it's sort of a wash. You know, they went out there and they just, the stage was what it was on that day.
A lot of that had to do with matchup, I think. Ish's best characteristics are playing bully ball, playing maybe over his size. Against St. Louis, it's hard to bully those guys.
I've talked about how much I think Hassan French is a man, so believe me.
Yeah.
That guy is, man, what a player.
You're going to find it very hard to score in the paint against them.
Yeah.
Even if you're big.
Yeah.
You know, never mind if you're a 6'2 guard who, yes, is strong, is physical, who plays bigger than 6'2, but you're going to go to the rim against those guys. You're going to have a hard time.
Point is, you know, I think he is a guy that is a building block for your future.
No question.
I think as a player, as a young man, I think the impressions, we haven't been able to be around him a lot, but the impressions we're getting is that, you know, he's got a good head on his shoulders. He's the guy that you want to say, okay, here's who I want to take with me, you know, to lead my program in the future. But it takes more than one guy,
right.
And which is why I think your analysis is fair. You know, you have the Mitchells, you know, going forward, and hopefully, you know, Makai comes back and he is healthy and can contribute for you the next couple of years. After that, you're right. You lose your two guys that are leading you in minutes per game, you know, Fats and Jeremy. I don't know. You know, I think you – it's tough to say that, okay, the direction the arrow is pointed, you know, upward and going in a place that you want it to go.
Right.
You know, there's still some work to do. I give the coaching staff, you know, credit for, you know, salvaging some of the losses and the turns that you had this past off season with some of the talent that you lost that you could still have in this program.
Right.
But left for other opportunities. But now it's about, okay, how can we point the arrow upward so that we are contending the way we want to contend in the Atlantic 10? That's going to be the question at the end of this season and moving forward.
Yeah, it's a really interesting calculus for URI. They could have as many as four games left here. They're supposed to play at Davidson on Saturday. The Wildcats are postponing games due to COVID protocols. They are not officially in a pause yet. But they are not playing. So as it stands right now, URI's next game will be Tuesday against Dayton. It will be on CBS Sports Network, 7 o'clock start. The Rams also have a game to reschedule with George Washington. Whether or not they get swapped out for another opponent, we'll see. You know, Rhodey could play as many as four Atlantic 10 games the rest of the way. They have until March 10th. To do it.
That's big window.
That's the first day of the Atlantic 10 tournament. You know, as I said when we started this segment on URI, they've done a wonderful job in terms of their discipline, in terms of staying off COVID pause,
yeah,
in terms of doing the right things, you know, adhering to the protocols. The fact that they played 21 games is something of a victory in itself.
Yes,
in
I agree.
Season.
I agree.
You know, and if that ends up being the highlight of this, you know, the way to spin this forward from the coaching staff to the players and saying, look, you know, you should be proud of yourselves. You've shown discipline. You've shown that you can be responsible off the floor. You know, let's maybe continue that into next year, continue that into our habits. You know, maybe push more of that into how we play on the court. If you're able to use that, you know, mentally as a building block, I think that would be a really good thing.
Absolutely.
For this program.
Absolutely.
You know, so that's coaching. That's a little bit of the mindset side, not necessarily the game night side that we see. You know, staffs can find motivation from God knows how many different areas. That could be one of them. And speaking of COVID pause, we get to Bryant, who is currently out of action still. You know, they are not playing. They are on COVID pause. That was announced last week on Thursday. So they are in day 8. Provided that they've had no more positive tests, they can come back in 10 days. Theoretically, they could start practice again on Monday. Whether or not they are able to do that, whether or not all their players and Tier 1 staff members are testing negative, we'll see. We hope that the Bulldogs are healthy and okay, and getting through quarantine okay. I can't imagine, as a college kid, if I was taken out of my dorm room and put into an off-campus hotel and not allowed to leave my room. We've talked a lot about mental health throughout this. I know at times I've really struggled with it. There have been some dark nights in Bill Koch's condo in Warwick. Some low moments for sure. Some reaching for the wet bar, perhaps, that is just off my kitchen. Maybe sometimes more reaching than there should be. I don't know how I would have dealt with this as a college kid. I don't wish it on any of them who are going through this. We hope to see Bryant back on the floor soon. When they do return, you're looking at a Northeast Conference picture that has changed considerably over the last week. They are one of four lost teams in the league, with Merrimack, Mount St. Mary's, and Wagner. As it stands, there will only be four teams going to the Northeast Conference tournament. And so Bryant, if they're able to reschedule the games that they are supposed to play, and if they win out, if they somehow manage to win out, they will be one of those four teams. So a nice feeling, I would imagine, to be able to control your own destiny. But a great amount of uncertainty in how they will come off this pause eventually and how they will play down the stretch.
And this is a difficult way to come back. If you are able to come back on time, you're looking at two games, not this weekend, but the following, against Merrimack. That would be your return. And Merrimack has jumped ahead of you by a half game in the standings. They're 7-4 now in the conference. Things have changed. I would like to criticize a co-host of yours on this podcast who got way ahead of himself the last time we were talking about the Bryant Bulldogs. A little excited because of the way they were playing. Maybe it was the broadcaster's curse that was put on them. If that is the case, I apologize to Jared Grosso and his staff for that. But look, I think they've been a very exciting team to watch all year, so I think that's why I got ahead of myself. But
wait, just to clarify, you're ripping yourself, or are you ripping Maury?
No, I'm ripping myself.
Oh, good. Okay.
Oh, gosh, no.
I'm here for this.
No. Maury did not get ahead of himself. You did not get ahead of yourself. I did, with the whole, oh, look, they could be more than a 16 seed in the NCAA tournament.
Oh, good. No, I like this. I like the accountability.
Listen,
continue.
Back to myself, and I'm like, jeez. You don't get too high. You don't get too low, Coy. What are you doing,
Very
kid?
Very good.
So, no, I'm ripping myself. They had a tough weekend at a Fairleigh Dickinson team that has guys in the conference that have been around the conference with Jenkins. And, it's a good team. And so
who have played in the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, it's a humbling experience that I
level.
Think Bryant had.
Yeah.
And they gave a little bit to me as well, humbling experience. Yeah, the conference picture has changed, and it can change quickly in any conference when you're talking about college hoops. And so now, and I think Jared Grosso, I think he and his staff, in some ways, this is probably a good thing for them, because running away with a conference can have its advantages and disadvantages too. The disadvantage being, are you battle tested? And now you're battle tested. Now you are up against it now. When you return from a COVID pause, which in itself is a battle, and you come back and you're going to play Merrimack right away, a team that now you are fighting with at the top of the conference, that is a heck of a way to, sort of face adversity here. And so, it's a tough return. And you said it, four lost teams, FDU, Mount St. Mary's, Wagner, and even the teams that are right behind them have five losses. Sacred Heart, FDU, LIU. This has all sort of gotten. Bryant is with the pack now in the NEC.
Right.
They're with the pack. They're not ahead like they were.
Right.
And that's the interesting thing, is they'll come back, and then they have LIU the following weekend, and then they've got Mount St. Mary's the following weekend. Like, this is. this is going to be a tough home stretch for the Bulldogs. So we're really going to see what they are made of. But with the way they've played, and if they can continue to play the way that they've played this year, they have shown the ability to win in different ways. And so if they do come back and play well, I'll say, you know, man, that's a heck of a test of your will and your character, because of the pause that you've gone on and then having to jump back on the court for these, you know, sort of high-level games in their own conference.
As they sit right now, they would play home and home with Merrimack next weekend. The 20th would be the first time that we could see Bryant back in action against the Warriors. What are they, the Warriors, the Golden Eagles? What are they now? Merrimack.
Merrimack's the Warriors. Yeah, sorry.
Are they?
Merrimack's the Warriors. Yep.
They are the Warriors.
Merrimack College Warriors, yep.
That was Marquette who changed the Golden
Eagles. I was just thinking, you're not talking about Merrimack. Are you talking about LIU? Because LIU's what, the Sharks?
The Sharks.
Sharks, no. Yeah.
Yeah, when right. they were LIU Brooklyn, they were the Blackbirds.
Blackbirds.
And now they are the Sharks, which, yes. I don't know, I kind of like the Blackbirds. That was kind of a...
Well, I'm a Beatles guy, so...
Well, oh, then you're all in on... Yeah, the Sharks
singing
just seems
in the
kind
dead of night.
Yeah, that's right. You know, but Bryant, as it stands now on their schedule, would play six games between February 20th and March 3rd, squeezing those in and playing teams who are up or around them in the NEC. You're playing Merrimack twice, Long Island twice, Mount St. Mary's twice. Merrimack and Mount St. Mary's are two of the other four lost teams. Long Island is 7-6 in the league, you know, so no slouch there under Derek Kellogg, a team that has competed at the top of the league since he went from Massachusetts to Brooklyn. You know, so a tough road for the Bulldogs. It's much more difficult than when they were 6-2 and sort of sitting pretty there in the NEC. Those two losses to Fairleigh Dickinson brought them back to the pack pretty quickly. They are still the best team in the league per KenPom. You know, they are still projected to finish comfortably in one of those four spots, but the margin for error is much smaller now than it was before.
Here's the good news for Bryant. With these games left on your schedule, 5 of 6 of them are at home.
That's great news.
And I know that this year home is different. Home and away is different for everybody because of the lack of crowd, fans, home cook, and all that sort of thing. But when you are on your home floor in your own gym, and I think particularly in the NEC, because let's face it, the Bulldogs, they don't draw a Dunkin' Donuts Center crowd.
No.
They're not getting a high level Atlantic 10 URI crowd to their games at the Chase Center.
Right.
They just don't have the capacity for that. You know, when they do get a nice you know, home playoff game and a nice environment there, it is pretty fun. I think back to Joe O'Shea's shot at the end of regulation in that playoff game against Sacred Heart a few years back.
Sure,
that was pretty
yeah.
fun.
Yeah.
That was really fun.
Yeah.
But they don't get that home, so they're not used to sort of 12,000 people at the Dunkin' Donuts Center for a game.
No.
So home to them is their own floor, their own bounces, their own rims, their own environment. And they're 6-0 at home this year. And so that speaks to being in your own barn. That means that you can control things, I think, the way that you, as much as possible, the way you want to control them. And so 5 of 6 at home, not having to travel in these COVID times, I think that does work to your advantage here if you're Bryant down the stretch.
Huge difference. You know, this past year has probably been the most uncomfortable any of us have been at any point. Us pampered Americans who have an easy life generally. This has certainly been the most out of routine that any of us have been. And I think any semblance of that, whether it's, as you mentioned, the gym that you practice in every day, your own bed, you know, not having to get on the bus, you know, not having to go to shoot around in the morning on the bus and then go back to the hotel and then back to the venue. You can just walk to the gym, get some shots up,
mm-hmm.
walk back to your dorm, take a nap if you want. It's your own bed. Feels good. Yeah, makes a huge difference, you would have to think. Any sort of creature comforts that you could find in this 2020-21 season, I think would make a huge difference. You're losing a lot without the crowds. You're losing a lot, you know, without the bands and you know, the pep squads and everyone else. It is not the same. You know, Coyde and I have both been at the Ryan Center for games. it is strange.
Yeah.
We would both tell you that. It is odd. We can't wait to have fans back. We really hope that next season everyone's vaccinated, all this is behind us, and there will be no more COVID restrictions. You know, but in Bryant's case, you're right. The advantage should be less. They've somehow managed to make it more so than you or I in Providence have. You know, so full credit to the Bulldogs. We hope they are back on the court as scheduled this coming week.
Yeah, first and foremost with them, before we, you know, you already said it, but I'll say it again. You know, before we get back to the basketball for the Bulldogs, you just hope that health is okay, that they are you know, you return here healthy with their guys all healthy, with their staff, with their coaches, and their families all healthy as possible. That's the most important thing we can say this season, especially when a team goes on pause like this.
Cody, this being a college basketball podcast, I want to wrap up with this. There's some breaking news at the Journal this week. The full retirement of the shooter.
Oh.
Billy Reynolds, our longtime columnist, the Brown University Hall of Famer. He is going to retire. He had been sort of on limited duty here over the past year or two, still filing his trademark For What It's Worth Saturday column. It's a piece that I grew up reading. It's part of the reason why I do what I do now. You know, quite frankly, Billy he's one of my heroes in the business. You know, and he has announced that he's going to step away and enjoy the golden years here as he gets into his 70s. I just, you know, Bill is just so synonymous with college basketball in this area, you know, with the game itself, with his passion for it, you know, with the way he's followed Brown and Providence and URI in more recent years, Bryant. You know, the way he's watched Atlantic 10 and the Big East for decades. You know, and I just wonder, you know, if you have any impressions, any recollections, any salutations for Billy Reynolds.
Well, first I'll say job well done, Bunky.
Yeah.
Job well done.
Yeah.
Bill is an institution, and that's clear. You know, I don't know Bill as much as you and Kevin McNamara and all the local writers here, and you know, even the guys that have been in TV here for a long time or grew up here. You know, I think of Frank and Yanni and how much they know Bill and, you know, grew up reading Bill.
Sure.
So, you know, you guys know Bill and have read him more than I have. But what always stands out about Bill is, and something that we can all strive for, whatever profession we get into, when Bill walks into a gym, it's striking to me how people come up to him, shake his hand. Coaches are just, when Bill comes to a Brown game, now particularly Brown, because I know he's, you know, playing Brown Bear himself.
Right.
You know, Mike Martin, just the amount of respect that I see from him, from Ed Cooley, from all of these guys that just know what Bill means, that's only something that we can strive for. And the only comparison, only thing I could compare it to, you know, in my head would be, you know, getting to work with Ken Bell at the end of his career.
Sure.
At Channel 6, and just the amount of respect that, you know, these guys exude because of the job that they've done for decades, and how they've done it, I think also plays into that. Because, you know, I think of Kenny the way I think of Bill. Like, he's done it with just you know, class, and has done it the best way possible, and people respect him for that. And so I hope Bill, I say the same thing to Bill that I said to Ken. I hope he gets to enjoy this next chapter of his life as much as possible. You know, be with the people that he wants to be with, do the things that maybe he didn't have time to do, and get away from, you know, all the grind. And I'm sure Bill's, we're going to see him in gyms. We're going to see him at games. When you do it for this long, it's just in your DNA. But I hope Bill gets to enjoy what he is going to do in his next chapter.
The best thing I could say about Bill Reynolds is and I tweeted this last week, Mark Patinkin wrote a great piece in tribute to Billy and talked to quite a few people in the market. It's a tricky thing to meet people who you admire, because a lot of times you admire them for the art that they've created or the things that they've done. You don't necessarily know who they are as people. And sometimes the tricky thing about that is they can disappoint you. They might not be nice people. They might not be genuine people. They might not be all that scintillating in person. You know, and I vividly remember, you know, this was long before I started working at the Journal. We were at a Words Unlimited banquet in Warwick, which is the state's association of sports writers, sports media members, you know, annual awards dinner. And as tradition, after the banquet, we would go to Dave's Bar and Grill, which is, you know, right down the street on Post Road in Warwick. And you know, there are quite a few of us there. And I had not actually met Bill Reynolds in person. I had, you know, I'd been around him a few times. I'd spoken with him a little bit, but, you know, just, hey, how you doing? You know, whatever. Walks right up to me and says, hey, Bill Reynolds, I really like what you do. I could have floated out of Dave's Bar and Grill. you know, the fact that he actually knew who I was, that he knew what I was doing, that he knew what I was covering, that he'd actually read my work and liked it, and it was genuine. You know, it wasn't just platitudes. It wasn't, you know, a 90-second thing where, you know, it was sort of the compulsory, hey, you know, I made sure you do a great job, and then you sort of turn away and that's it. And you mean it, but you don't. You know, you might say that you know, but you don't. It was obvious that wasn't the case. And this was at a point in my career where I couldn't do anything for Bill Reynolds. I couldn't help him in any way. There was no way that I could provide any sort of tangible professional value to him. You know, but the fact that he took an interest in me at that point, the fact that he was so genuine, you know, especially when I started to work here and got to work alongside him, you know, he treated me like I'd been here for 30 years, you know, not like I was the new kid or, you know, anything like that. You know, he exceeded personally anything that I could have thought about him professionally. You know, and I would just say that it was an honor to work alongside him. It really was. His accomplishments speak for themselves. I mean, the amount of times that he's been Sports Writer of the Year in the state,
yeah.
The books that he's done, you know, obviously Fall River Dreams is a classic.
Tremendous.
A must read. You know, if you grew up in this region, if you follow basketball, you know, really, if you're just looking for a slice of Americana, growing up in high school and sort of, you know, being adults way before you're ready to be adults. The story of Chris Herron and his teammates at Durfee in the early 90s. It's just captivating stuff. Really just raw and honest and powerful, like so much of Bill's writing was in his books or in his columns. You know, I will miss him. You know, I hope he's doing well. I hope he might drop in and give a listen to this. You know, we wish the best to his longtime companion, Liz Abbott, as well. She is a saint. Billy has a very active mind, a very active social life, and Lizzie has unending patience with Bill and his ways. You know, so we love her. She's the best. With that, Coity, I think we will sign off. We'll give the shooter the last shot on this podcast.
Love it.
And we know the ball is in good hands if we're giving it to him. So, folks, we hope that you're well. We hope that you're enjoying the games and feeling healthy. And we look forward to being back with you soon. Thank you very much.